This edition of Talking HR with Lori and Lisa, where as always, our goal is to give you a real look at today's HR world, the sharing of experiences, knowledge, and inspiring people practices. I'm your host, Lori Rolkoff.
And I'm Lori's co-host, Lisa Fuller. This is our first podcast for 2024, and we're very pleased to have Richard Johnson, co-founder and partner of Ascent Employment Law, together with Veronica Ukrainitz, associate counsel, join us today. Richard and Veronica both support their clients and businesses to rise above their employment issues through practical expertise and guidance. Recognizing legal matters can be challenging and filled with emotion, Richard has the experience to handle the most complex legal matters with fairness, empathy, and respect. And I've worked with Veronica through the years and certainly can attest that she has a similar perspective. She is a strong advisor, business partner, and has a sophisticated understanding of the laws applicable to the workplace, the complex dynamic of workplace relationships, and extensive knowledge of related human resource matters. Welcome, Richard and Veronica. We're super excited to have you on our podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You got a lot to tell us about today, don't you?
Sure do. Lots of exciting things on the agenda.
Well, let's dive right in then. We want to hear about sort of the current employment litigation issues that are experienced by employers and workplaces and what employers need to be mindful of. So I'll let both of you kick it off. Where do you want to start?
Well, I was thinking when Veronica and I were discussing topics, we wanted to come up with, you know, what's cutting edge and the sexiest of employment law issues. And so the first one that we get asked commonly about are just employee rights in general. So employers sometimes are so focused on managing their businesses, understandably, that thinking about things from the employee's standpoint a little bit and thinking about employee rights can sometimes be not at the forefront. So we thought that would be a good place to start.
Well, I've never heard employment law called sexy, but I'm interested now in what you're going to tell us.
Oh, just wait. Just wait. So if Veronica's okay, I think what I'll do is just kind of discuss a few of the nuts and bolts that I'm seeing and then pass it over to her, and then she can give us her opinions on kind of what she's seeing on her side of the fence. We often are asked about employee issues, both in the labor unionized context, as well as the non-union context. And Veronica practices so much on the labor side compared to myself. And so she's a real touchstone whenever labor issues come up for me. But my practice focuses mainly on the non-union issues. And so we look at a few different things. When we're looking at employee rights, and we're looking at how we're supposed to manage our employees, we're looking at the Employment Standards Act for the most part, right? And so that's the touchstone from a statutory point of view for provincially governed employees. And, you know, there are some people who will come in that we deal with that are in the federally governed sphere. So First Nations, for example, aviation, grain silos. Dazzle your friends with that tidbit at a party. Grain silos are a federally governed operation. Nuclear operations as well, like nuclear power plants, things like that, telecommunications. So in that sphere, employees derive their rights from the Canada Labor Code as the employment standards legislation that applies. So we've got to be really conversant in jurisdictional issues. We've got to think about, okay, as businesses, which piece of legislation applies? What's going to govern overtime? What's going to govern vacation pay, vacation time off? You know, all the nuts and bolts that really are the fundamental pieces that the legislature says we need to watch for to make sure people are treated fairly. And that's really what a large number of employers come to us for is, okay, in applying those and putting them into contracts, what does that look like? We'll also have some employees that have been legacied, I will call them. They've been around maybe in our businesses for a long time and they might not have a contract. And this happens a lot when there's a transition of the business. So, you know, a purchaser takes over and they find out, uh-oh, there are a bunch of people who've been here for 30 years, 20 years, and they add so much to the business. But if at some point there's a, you know, a dismissal that's needed to be carried out and there's no contract, we have to look to the decisions of the courts called the common law, right? And that will govern really an employee's entitlement. So sometimes that can come as a bit of a surprise. So we're really always encouraging our employers to have good contracts in place and be watching to update those from time to time. So that's kind of the lay of the land from what I'm seeing, Veronica, as a staple. What about you?
Yeah, I'd say the same. And the interesting thing too is individuals, your employees, often don't know their rights. So like our firm, Ascent Employment Law, does support individuals with their employment law issues as well as businesses. And so we do find that knowledge is a powerful thing, and trying to keep hidden from employees their rights or how to access their rights will often backfire on you, because we've got the famous Google search tool, and then employees will go to that, and then they don't necessarily understand that, oh, they might come under the Canada Labor Code as opposed to the Employment Standards Act, or what's a workers' compensation issue versus an employment standards issue. So we do support, you know, employees being informed of their own rights. And in related to these employee right issues, like Richard began by talking about labor unionized work environments. And so often there's a perception by individuals as well as businesses that if you're in a unionized workplace, that the union dictates all of the minutiae of employee rights around a workplace. And that simply isn't the case. The default in a unionized workplace is that unless a collective agreement, which is the contract between the union and the employer, addresses an issue, management rights prevail. So the management gets to decide. And so often, as I said, there's an erroneous belief that if it isn't in the collective agreement, the employer cannot do it. Well, it's actually the reverse. If it isn't addressed in a collective agreement, typically the employer can do whatever they're seeking to do, although it would be prudent to get legal advice. Mm-hmm. And so that's important to keep in mind. Another perception in unionized workplaces, for example, is that probationary employees don't have any rights under the collective agreement. And that's not the case either. They have lesser protections under a collective agreement, but they certainly do have protections in terms of, for example, a dismissal. They, at a minimum, have a right to be told prior to being dismissed for unsuitability that they, how the employee was not meeting expectations and given a reasonable opportunity to respond. And of course, it's always best to have that in some form of writing so that you're not into a who said what to whom, when, and denials around that. But those, in essence, are the areas where we'll see employees get their rights, is collective agreements, legislation, Employment Standards Act, Canada Labor Code. And when there's gaps in all of that, the courts will step in under the common law. The last component I would just offer up is that under a collective agreement, collective agreements don't entirely replace employment standards legislation. There are certain provisions of employment standards legislation that apply even if a collective agreement is silent. And for example of that, that would be all of the leave provisions under employment standards legislation, including the more recent paid sick leave entitlements in BC, such as the 5 paid sick days. So even if that is not addressed in a collective agreement, there are provisions of the Act that say they do apply. So it can be quite complicated.
And I guess there's other things like human rights and even workers' compensation and other legislation that can impact how we manage our workplaces besides the ones you've mentioned there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're finding that the part of the complexity for business owners, no matter what the size of the operation, is keeping all of the various moving parts clear. Because you're, as you say, you've got employee rights that might come from a collective agreement or might come from a contract or even common law. And then you might have a human rights issue coming up that affects somebody's maternity leave or disability accommodation. And that's derived from human rights legislation, another layer. And then you've got workers' compensation, which, as most of us know, is getting increasingly complex, and they're opening up new avenues for complaint that employees can make for retaliation, mental disorders, et cetera. So you've got to keep your eyes on a few different levels and a few different statutory schemes to manage it all. So it's quite complex, and we love guiding our clients through that.
And of course, an organization's own policies that they write to, which constrains their rights in a sense, in addition to all those other aspects.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's correct, Lori. And in a unionized workplace, that's where we often speak to a management right to set policy. But the unions do have the right to challenge a policy as being unreasonable. So a management right is not an absolute right. It's not an unfettered right, and policies can't be unfair or discriminatory or unconscionable, too extreme. And so unions are certainly entitled to challenge those to ensure that there is a balancing of the management right to run and operate the workplace and an employee right not to be walked over in the course of that.
Is there a responsibility for the employers to make the employees aware of their employee rights as part of that employment relationship as well?
We do a fair, is it okay if I jump in, Veronica, on this one, just because it's at the forefront of my mind?
Sure. Actually, I'm going to butt in ahead of you on one little point. It's a historical point, being that there was at one point in the Employment Standards Act a requirement that employers put up a poster in the staff room explaining people's rights. So that I do not, and Richard may correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not believe that's any longer a requirement.
My trusty co-pilot is correct. And I mean, just work out in Ontario, and they still have the posting of certain things that are required under WSIB, but you're right, in BC, no, not in terms of that.
Which is great. That's why I asked, because you know, those are some of the unknowns that employers honestly don't know what they do need to do, and those things that they don't necessarily need to do. So that's great insight.
And one area that we do find that there is an obligation, a positive obligation on employers, is perhaps with the bullying and harassment changes that came about years ago now. All BC employers have to have a bullying and harassment policy. And with that comes a positive duty to train your staff and to review the policy annually. So there is that obligation, but otherwise it really arises where you've got certain terms that you want to enforce at the end of the relationship, like severance. You can't hide in the weeds and somehow obscure those and then try to rely on them. They have to be clear. But WorkSafe is a good example where I feel there's a positive obligation to go in and do training, for example.
Awesome. So that leads us into the next topic, changing an employee's position, a balance of rights.
Yeah, and I think we put our heads together on this one. Veronica, what are you seeing in terms of changing an employee's position? Because I feel like 2024 came in like a lion, and I had a lot of inquiries about this, but what about you? Like, you know, what are your views
on it? Definitely. You know, we're in a technological revolution, and what we are finding is, as with other revolutions, the Industrial Revolution and whatnot, is that employees are finding that the demands on their position are changing quite quickly. And not all employees are able to keep up with those changes in their position. And so, and in addition, and this may be a function of the economy tightening and inflation, employers are being stressed to be operationally efficient so they can stay in business. And without our employer organizations operating, employees don't have jobs. So there is this fine tension. And so definitely, as Richard's saying, I've been dealing with a lot of, I've got to reorganize the business, or we've introduced technology into the business. We've introduced cloud-based filing. We've introduced, you know, email. We've introduced automated telephone systems. So often what we're getting is that 30-year employee who was our receptionist and did all our filing. Well, we don't need filing cabinets. We don't need anyone to answer our phones and things like that. And that's, again, where we get into the intersection of rights, where that employee may perceive that they're being let go because they're older, because they've been there 30 years, say, and they're in their 60s, when in reality, what's happened is that their position is redundant, you know, due to very, very swift implementation of technology. So we are seeing that. And then we're also seeing the terminology of, and as Richard was saying, am I getting these inquiries? Yes. I had a local government employer contact me saying, we need to make organizational change. And if we promote this person, is it a constructive dismissal? If we ship this person's reporting authority, is it a constructive dismissal? If we reduce a job, change a job? So we often get asked that. And then when we represent employees, employees would come to us and say, I believe I've been constructively dismissed. But nobody really understands what that means. So there's a considerable educational component to us assisting our clients in understanding what a constructive dismissal means, and then what that individual wants to do with that information.
Veronica, just when you were talking about the new technology that's coming in, I was recollecting back in the day when there were a lot of clauses going into collective agreements about redundancy due to technology. And at that time, it was about PCs generally coming onto desks and replacing typists or people who had done work in a unionized environment specifically to do with producing documents. And suddenly management were able to produce documents themselves using the PCs. Do you see any similarities with what's going on currently to when that was happening, probably back in the 80s, early 90s?
I do, Lori, and I think we're both giving away our age here.
I think so.
We were working when that was going on. And you're right, like collective agreements, and often they still have this. It's a bit archaic now. They have what's called technological change provisions. And it's archaic just because the terminology has become more broad and liberal. So the Canada Labor, the BC Labor Relations Code, and probably the Canada Labor Relations Code back in the late 80s, early 90s, did require that employers have technological change provisions and outline how they were supporting these employees, what was their layoff rates if they couldn't adapt, how could they be retrained, and things like that. And that's been replaced by a provision in our labor relations code called number section 54, which is more general, basically saying if there's any substantial changes in the workplace, the employer has an obligation to enter into an adjustment plan to do its best to minimize the impact. So there's no guarantee of job security. Like jobs will change and some will disappear, but the idea is to minimize the impact and help get people trained up. So yes, we're definitely seeing that. And what we're seeing with our clients, whether they're unionized or not, is they want to keep these people, but people must adapt. Like it's a survival. It's a survival need. We must all adapt to change. So in order to maintain our employment, if we're so lucky as to be close to retirement, some of us might be able to retire and call it quits. But even then, you've got to adapt to change in retirement. You can't go to the same old bank you went to in the 90s and expect that same teller to be standing there helping you. So it is important to address that.
Well, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna make a joke about referring to going to the teller, but I won't even touch that. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, and just even with AI, you know, it's a big topic now, and the legalities of AI entering the workforce and ChatGPT and different things. Any thoughts on AI from a technological perspective?
Well, not to lift the veil here, but, you know, even internal to our law firm, we have a lot of discussions about AI. And, you know, believe it or not, it's coming whether we like it or not. And I'm maybe on the more cautious side as opposed to one of my partners who's really championing the use of technology and has a very adapt or die kind of mentality, which is you need balance, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that a lot of employers are looking to see where they can trim their bottom line in ways that are effective, use technology to be delivering more efficient services or deliver services more efficiently. But they're really sweating over these decisions, like Veronica mentioned, where they have people who may be doing quote unquote redundant tasks, but they really aren't trying to keep them. And they are looking at ways to maybe retrain or help people adapt to the technology to oversee that where it's possible. So I'm hopeful that even with the introduction of tools, judgment functions, where we do have the need for human capacity, human emotion and judgment calls and all of those things, it still leaves a place for us, you know, flesh and blood people. And I think a lot of employers are seeing that, and they're just trying to work within what tech holds. And there is there's another interesting spin on this, and it's been around for a long time, but the Canada Labor Code has pretty strong protections on people's right to employment after 12 months specifically. So if you've got a 5-year employee under the Canada Labor Code, you need to have just cause or a lack of work or discontinuance of function. So federally, there is this recognition that sometimes positions are, they go by the wayside. Sometimes technology will cause a position to be defunct and just no longer useful in the organization. And that can be good reason for a dismissal federally. But provincially, there's still money that you have to pay if you're dismissing people. And it's tough. These are tough decisions. And that's what we help people through.
Yeah. And when we talk about these balancing of rights, changing people's positions, the influx or the effect of technology is, I'll circle back to this constructive dismissal concept. Often we get asked this by the employee or by an employer. So I've been constructively dismissed, or does this mean we constructively dismiss that person because we've made these changes? And so there's often what I'll actually say to people, and I tend to have a more practical element to this. I'm happy to give them the education that a constructive dismissal happens in law when there is a fundamental, substantial change to an individual's terms and conditions of employment. However, what does that mean in reality? Like Richard has referred to, well, when things change and a position is redundant, you may be dismissed. So often what I will say if I'm representing an individual is, well, what you need to understand is if you want to step forward with the position that change is fundamental, the outcome of that is what you're saying is it's intolerable to me and I have been effectively dismissed. So it's like being in a horrible relationship and saying, I need out of this relationship. And then we're saying, well, what you're doing is quitting and saying, pay me my severance. And the employer may be saying, no, we don't want you to quit. We want to keep you. We want you to adapt to this change. So you get this arm wrestle. But often what we're advising them is you may end up negotiating a severance package. But often when we represent individuals, they seem to think that by saying constructive dismissal, they can fight the change and make the change not happen. And that isn't the case. All they can do is put up the best negotiation for a reasonable severance package. But then I'll often say to them, so do you understand you may be a, 8-year employee, 50 years old, and making $100,000 a year, and maybe we can get you between X and Y dollars, but then you don't have a job. Or you can adapt to this change and continue to work for this employer and continue to have a job. And so consider your future, short-term gain, long-term gain. And for some people, the change is just unacceptable and they have to go. But that's our discussion, whether it's with an individual or with an employer, to say a lot of this is about the conversation you're having with each other and the understanding that if you can't see eye to eye, it's probably best if that person leaves the organization and then you're negotiating a severance. But that's what a constructive dismissal gets you. You can't stop change. It will ultimately result in the person becoming temporarily unemployed, possibly getting a decent severance, possibly not getting a decent severance, and then having to move on in life. So those are some of the harsh realities that we're often trying to explain to our clients. And Richard does it much more compassionately than me.
I was just going to refer to you as Veronica Tough Love Ukrainians. But I don't know, like, they are tough conversations, and I think it's really difficult to say to someone, look, if you're representing an individual, you could go ahead and you could protest the change, and then you're probably going to get notice of the change, and they're going to institute it properly. You may not like the process that was followed, but it doesn't mean the change in and of itself, as Veronica said, can't happen. Employers have rights, and you have to look for practical solutions. So I think both sides need to come at these issues with a bit of practicality and transparency, because they're not talking in a lot of cases. Talk about the rationale. Why do you need to make the change? Will the employee understand it? Probably, if you explain it. they understand dollars and cents and budgets. And so I think a lot of it is communication. And I do think it's, you know, it's a very gray area these days compared to the age old. I've been demoted from a silly example, you know, mid-level management down to being a janitor. Like, that's a silly example, but those bright line constructive dismissals, we're not dealing with those as often anymore. We're dealing with compensation changes, commission percentages are changing, or bonus structures are changing, or bullying and harassment situations, and things that are less, they're in the gray.
And we're also dealing with areas where employers are merging or employers are shrinking. And so a person may have a job that did have three direct reports that now doesn't have any, but it's still a responsible job. The job might have got more specialized and technical. And so we'll often get that of, well, I was the finance director with three employees reporting into me, but due to technological advancements, I'm still the finance director, but I have no team any longer. And so then there'll be this perception of loss of status. So again, my conversation with those individuals is, well, you get paid pretty well to still ultimately do the core job of finance, and it's pretty risky to take that one to court and hope to get a severance. And so sometimes part of my tough love conversations are, if you're bitterly unhappy there with the change, why don't you ride it out, keep getting paid, and just look for another job. And so, but there is often this perception that I've been there 10 years, I have a right to a severance, and the employer's made me so bitterly unhappy, I'm going to hang in there till I get that severance. And I say, is it really worth it? Like, you might be depressed, you might be suffering from actual diagnosed depression by the time you're done this. So maybe this is a good opportunity to look and talk about, and again, when Richard talks about transparency with your employer, sometimes those are great conversations to have with your supervisor, a trusted manager, or human resources, to say, I'm not adapting well to this. Will you support me in my transition to other employment? Will you give me a reference? Will you, you know, lighten up my workload so that I can do some other interviewing? Will you present me with some kind of transitional severance support as I leave? And often employers will say, I see that. I see you're struggling. So yeah, let's talk about that. So yeah, lawyers often get involved because people aren't communicating very effectively with each other.
Well, in an ideal world, you know, from an HR perspective, we'd be talking about change management and preparing the organization, preparing our employees for the changes that are coming. But changes are so rapid now. And we all know even a cultural change can take years to actually happen. You know, how can we support our employees so that they can deal with the changes that are coming in and be able to stay with us when we want them to stay with us and when they want to stay, but they're just having difficulty coping with that?
Can I give a quick unsolicited plug? This is where, in my opinion, HR and people in culture can do a phenomenal job getting involved, whether it's an external consultant who comes in to help with change, or somebody who's in-house, you know, the in-house HR department or professional, because when a lawyer gets involved, it naturally heightens things. And we're great people, I'd like to think. Right, Veronica?
Absolutely.
But I know that not everybody necessarily feels at ease when lawyers are involved, and that's understandable. But if you can have someone who comes in with the skills to be able to help everybody manage the relationship through change, like I know a lot of very excellent professionals can in the HR realm, that can be really, really useful. And so I will actually advocate for that for clients to say, don't pay me to come in and try to help with this issue, because it's going to be like a hammer. Get somebody to come in and help navigate the change and explain to the employees, so it's not taking away your bandwidth as an owner or as a manager dealing with day-to-day business. You know, leave the professional work to somebody who knows how to do that stuff, so it's not on your plate as an owner.
Very important. Just my 2 cents. Yeah, no, and it is very important, and that change management piece and support and helping people navigate the change and being compassionate and empathetic and taking the time they need to hear them as well. I think it's, and explaining the changes you mentioned already, Richard, I think that's so critical. And sometimes things are moving so fast for employers. They don't explain the why behind things, but it is, you know, many of us know there's mergers, acquisitions, the big companies, you know, amalgamate and take over a smaller company, and economic times are difficult. So they have to do whatever they can. And I often think, you know, if they don't do that, then they won't stay in business and you won't ultimately have a job either. So it's always trying to find that balance for everybody. Absolutely.
And employers are not omniscient. They do not know that the changes they're implementing will necessarily be effective. They may have hired a battery of consultants to help them get through that, and it may go sideways. And it's not, in the vast majority of cases, it's not intentional. Right. And another area of change we caution employers, and it's often after the fact that we get this, which is when there's what looks like positive change, when an individual is promoted or given additional duties and responsibilities, and even in that case where they get, I try give them some more money if you can. Don't just layer that on or you get resentment. But it's to keep in mind too that as much as you may want to keep an individual, that might not be the appropriate individual to promote or layer on more work. So we often refer this in our world as the Peter principle, that somebody's been over promoted. And then that's just demoralizing for everybody to have said, you know, we took a supervisor and made him a director of this department and it didn't work. So now we have to let them go. So, and again, collective agreements, unionized workplaces somewhat protect for this, where they'll say there's a trial period. And if a person's moving to another position, they'll have 3 or 6 months, for example, to trial that and have a right to revert. But that does not apply when someone's moved into a position in a management side that the collective agreement no longer protects them. And so we unfortunately do deal with those as a function of this change, where it's like, well, it didn't work out. And so now we're negotiating a severance. And then often those individuals are so stressed at not being able to cope in the job that they've gone on medical leave. And so now we have further dynamics, as Richard mentioned before, of an employee on medical leave who's not suited to the job. You need the job filled, but in law, you're supposed to hold it open. And so that's another area where HR consultants and in-house HR can just be invaluable to really assess whether a person's fit for the role. Like, I've had clients when after the dismissal and we're in court, we're looking at a psychometric assessment done by an external party. And I've said, did you guys not read this before you put the person in the job? They said, well, no, we did it on hire, but we never looked at it again. We promoted him 3 times. I'm like, clearly his psychometric's not compatible with the position you put him in. And everyone forgot about it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So maybe I'll just build on this conversation a little more. And we're having such great, great dialogue, but reasons for dismissal. What are some of the employer obligations and employee entitlements if somebody does need to ultimately end that employment relationship?
I can jump in here if I may, because this is a bit of a, I've had this question a lot, and I've got my own views on this. And I think people need to, from a human standpoint, reconcile change and departure and grieve that. And not to get too touchy-feely here, but it's the human element of losing a job. It's losing a relationship, right? And so when you're going through those changes from an organization, particularly after a long period of time, not having a place to put that and reconcile it can be really, really tough. But on the employer side, it's usually not a problem to provide a gentle but accurate reason. However, you're legally not obliged to. And in most cases that we're dealing with in the non-unionized sector, and actually in the unionized sector too, you're dealing with cause versus without cause. Most cases, 99% of cases where there's a dismissal in the non-unionized context will be a without cause dismissal. Right? When you're talking about somebody who's been let go involuntarily. And I don't have an issue with providing a reason if it's going to help to smooth over that departure. And if I had a nickel for every time a client has talked to me and said, if they just talked to me at the end of the relationship, I wouldn't be sitting here. I hear that time and time again. And part of that is messaging the departure. But employers feel like if they say anything, they're going to get in trouble, which I understand. They don't want to say the wrong thing and step in it. But it's really, really important to just consider what you'd need to hear as a human being when you're departing an organization, and then put kindness to it, frankly. And when there's nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all, you know, childhood wisdom. So I think that those things are really important. And then reference letters also become a parallel issue. When someone's leaving an organization, unless there's cause being asserted, you can usually say something in a letter. And we call a toned down letter a letter of work record. And it can say the employee was with us in this role from X to Y. And here's some duties. Even that can help. And so I think it's important to consider what messaging you can give to third parties for those opportunities where they're going to go and interview and an employee is going to go out and try to, you know, seek reemployment. That's my two cents on it anyways.
Yeah, I think that's important because I know as an HR professional, it was always like, even without cause, you don't say anything because you're afraid that it will create a legal issue. So, and recently that has shifted where it's, as you said, you can say a little bit to help that transition for that individual, because that is the kind way to help them move forward as well. So,
and what I will caution is, you know, in some cases it's inappropriate because it will open Pandora's box. So you don't want to open up a situation where your words are going to be used as some sort of a WCB, illegal work safe complaint or something mm-hmm. like that. You don't want to go into that necessarily without a bit of advice and thinking about how that's all going to play out. But I just think, you know, in a lot of cases, that's exactly right. You don't want to say anything for fear of getting in trouble. And mm-hmm. most of the time, there's a way through that.
I think at the minimum, to think about the person's transition, you know, they're moving away from people they worked with every day. They, you know, their work may have been important to them, and suddenly that's gone. And so how do we make sure that they can comfortably adjust to this new life that they have? What sort of resources can you provide as an employer through a dismissal, such as even an EAP support or transitional coach or, you know, help with finding other employment? But think about, you know, someone particularly who may have worked for you for a really long time and now is out in the workforce again, trying to find new employment. It's a new world. They don't know where to look or how to look. I think that would help a lot and go a long way for employers to help employees with more empathy and support after they leave.
The other conversation, Richard, go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree wholeheartedly. And I think the EFAPs and the EAPs and the outplacement counseling, or maybe turning your mind towards specialized outplacement counseling if somebody's in a niche role or a niche industry, those kinds of things I think can really be useful. Sorry, Veronica.
Well, what I wanted to just talk a little bit about too, and we're probably getting close to the end of our time, is just this terminology of cause without cause. And so often we will have clients call and say, do I have cause to terminate? And I'll say, why are you asking that? And they'll say, well, because this person did something and I want to let them go. And I'll say, well, you don't, if you're not unionized, there you can let an individual go. There's an obligation to give reasonable working notice of termination or provide them with an appropriate severance, either as per the contract, the stats, employment standards, or according to the court. So there requires some guidance there. And they'll say, but I want to know if I have cause. And I'll say to them, well, in law, when an employer is terminating an individual for cause, they are marching them out the door. Their last paycheck is the paycheck that took them to today, plus whatever vacation accrual they might have, and nothing else. And that person may have a mortgage, children to feed, extraordinary crushing debt, we don't know. And so cause in the legal world is viewed as like the capital punishment of termination. And it is extremely, even if everyone thinks that person deserved it, because perhaps they were, say, embezzling from the company, that person, and it's really unfortunate, and at the other end of the sexy spectrum in our business, is that that person, we've had clients who have had employees and our own clients have suicide attempts and sometimes successful. So cause literally can be a capital punishment for some individuals. And so I'll often have the conversation with the person about, you know, why is this so important to you? And they'll usually say, oh, well, we didn't understand that. We just want to know if we can let them go. And then what's our responsibility to the individual? So we're back to the kindness and compassion in and perhaps ending the employment relationship because all trust is lost. But, you know, the worst thief may well have a gambling problem and a huge debt and be sitting on the cusp of personal bankruptcy. So we'll never know the story behind why our employees behave the way they do.
I hear a lot of HR concepts coming into this conversation.
Well, I'm dealing with a situation right now where the ROE is the issue that's causing a lot of angst, right? Because if there's an allegation of cause, then you worry about your eligibility for EI. And so even that safety net can be pulled out from under you and you've got to fight for EI potentially, right? So yeah, it's just this slippery slope of these cascading hurdles that you've got to jump through if you can even rebound psychologically from the dismissal itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all really, really great points. I feel like we could talk for like several hours because I have looming questions, but I might have to reserve those for a future episode.
I told you, these are all sexy topics, very exciting things.
Employment law is very exciting, but I think it's really helpful for our listeners it brings awareness and it brings the topics close to mind so they can navigate and do so in a manner that really treats employees with dignity and respect and compassion, because this life is hard. Let's face it, the working environment's getting harder and harder. So you want to try to support employers, try to support employees, and have everybody be successful.
So until go ahead.
No apologies.
No, I was just, you know, our time is coming to a close, and I wanted to make sure that our listeners were able to reach out to you if they need some help before we have our next episode with you. How can they do that?
Veronica?
Well, the best way is through our website, which is the www.assetemploymentlaw.ca. And so you can jump on our website and there are ways to book individual appointments with lawyers. They all go through an intake person or to book an intake. So that's the most effective way to reach out to us, is that you can reach out there. And if there's a specific lawyer you want to reach, you can certainly ask for that lawyer. Interestingly, today I had an individual say, "We can't book you, Veronica, on the website." And I said, "No, I don't like that. I don't like having appointments show up in my calendar." So I said, "You have to go the old fashioned way, not the AI way, and make a call and book me."
Absolutely. So, and if people do want to call, 604-800-5722 is our phone number. And also you can reach out at hello@ascentemploymentlaw.ca. And we would be happy to have any inquiries or questions. We always love that. Thank you.